This is a production of Cornell University.
Well, I have to honestly admit in a couple of things. Back when I first started doing some of this research and I published a few papers, like you said, and I got contacted by a lot of people about what I was doing, it got to the point that it was somewhat overwhelming. So I put together a whole series of canned emails that I'd send back to students. And I hope none of them were you. No, I really did. I almost had to some degree, put some things packaged together that I could send out. But it was great because I was seeing a lot of interest in people looking at climate and growing grapes and making wine, and what really we knew or didn't know about the future of this industry. So anyway, it's been a lot of fun doing this kind of research. I've been very fortunate to do something I think that is extremely interesting, quite diverse, and it takes me to some great places in the world, and arguably to interact with a lot of people as well in terms of doing some great research. I have an image here. I don't necessarily see him here, but I change this image on the left virtually every talk I give, and I'm going to ask everybody here, what grape-growing region is that? Anybody have any idea?
Chile.
Or Chile? So this is a place you need to visit. This is eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, near Walla Walla. Rolling hillsides that largely have been planted in wheat, but are starting to be planted more and more into grapevines, and they are spectacularly beautiful, both in the springtime when everything is green, and then later on in the summer like this when the background landscape turns brown and the vineyards are left in green. So anyway, that's just a little bit of a divergence from the talk. So I'm going to talk largely about a collection of what I call the influences, risks, and challenges relative to climate. And for me, as a climatologist, as I look at this industry and this system, essentially, is that there are really three very distinct spatial and temporal influences and or risks to viticulture and wine production. And they're pretty straightforward. I think that most people would get a sense of this. First of all, there are individual weather events. These are very short-term, localized type of events, such as hail, frost freezes, heavy rain, etc. There's also climate variability. Climate variability tends to be very seasonal to decadal. It tends to be somewhat regionalized. You're getting a similar signal over a given region. This tends to manifest itself in either maybe a dry period or a wet period or some period that is much warmer or colder than another. So climate variability can be very prominent. Then we're also in this framework of climate structure or climate change. And what I'm getting at here is long-term, regional to kind of global kind of structure for climate. And in this case, average temperature, rainfall regimes, how much water is available, warming, cooling, or changes in moisture overall. And so each one of these, I think, are very germane to everything I do, trying to understand these relative impacts or influences or challenges relative to growing grapes and making wine. They also manifest themselves in three different things: crop risk, production and quality variability, and suitability. Now, I do research across each one of these areas, but largely what I'm going to talk about today a little bit is this, the second two here, getting at the idea of what is a suitable landscape for growing grapes relative to its climate. So from that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off and talk about structure and suitability. This is arguably what got me interested in the whole area of climate's role in growing grapes and making wine, was trying to understand why individual varieties and or the entire Vitis family does what it does in the climates that it is grown in. So this diagram here that I'm going to show in just a second is related to looking at wine production from a quality standpoint, and understanding that it results from what I call four ripeness clocks. People, I think, have talked about this in different ways looking at this issue, but the way I look at it is that there's four ripeness clocks that are running simultaneously, but they're running at different rates. And we all know that sugar accumulation, acid respiration, phenolic ripeness, and character are the main types of things that we need to understand how they develop overall in terms of grapevine development. This diagram was in Practical Vineyard Winery a while back, and I've used it quite a bit. If you haven't seen this, or some of you teach this is a very good diagram to get at the idea of what's happening in the growth cycle of a grapevine. You know, basically what we're seeing here is that we're starting over here at bud break, or I'm sorry, at flowering. We're going from flowering to harvest, and we're looking at compound accumulations, berry development over time, sugar development over time, and then how material is either moving up or down within the vine system itself. Now, there's a lot of things to talk about in here, but what I think is very important in terms of the research that I've been trying to do is trying to look at this system and trying to understand what these thresholds and or balance issues are. And so as we look at over time, as sugar is going up and berry size is changing, acidity is also dropping out to a certain level. We also know that fruit character goes from being vegetal, herbal, to fruity, to jammy, to cooked. And so somewhere over here, there's a balance zone. My family's vineyard, anybody growing grapes anywhere in the world, wants to optimally grow their fruit so that they can harvest over here in a balance zone in which they get that optimum acidity, sugar balance with the right phenolic and fruit character that they're looking for. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. So my interest really has been trying to understand what these kind of thresholds and or balance zones are overall. And looking at this, this is a very simplistic diagram that puts wine production and or quality metrics on the y-axis and climate metrics on the x-axis. Many different ways you can define this, but if you look at this as a what I call variety climate thresholds, it's pretty straightforward. It's a parabolic response. I think it's pretty clear that we know that somewhere over on this side there's a too cold of a threshold. Either the region's too cold or maybe that vintage was too cold, and the situation is you end up with potentially lower sugar levels, unripe flavors, and unbalanced wines. Anything back over here in this kind of climate structure. We also know that somewhere over here there's too warm of a threshold. Too warm of a given vintage and or a given region for a given variety, and you have lower retention of acids, overripe flavors, and unbalanced wines. So my interest has always been these thresholds, and what is this optimum zone for any individual variety, and can we define it? Do we really know what that is? Do we know where we're going to be growing a grape in a climate that provides consistent sugar levels, ripe flavors, and generally balanced wines? We know that there's going to be vintage variations in there due to extreme events, but overall, this would be essentially what I would call the sweet spot. And so defining those thresholds is something that I've been very interested in. Now, as we look at this in terms of thinking about climate change, the other issue comes about, are these thresholds fixed for any given variety, or do they have some kind of plasticity? It's very possible that we have management plasticity over the short term where we can adapt and allow that variety to have a much greater potential in that climate. And it's also possible that varieties themselves have some long-term adaptability that may make them widen their thresholds to the optimum zone. So again, this is kind of this area that I've been very interested in trying to study and understand more about grapevines. I'm going to come back and talk about this a little bit more, but just to kind of give a piece of this, I arguably think we know more about this cold climate threshold than we know about the too warm threshold for the vast majority of all varieties. And I think that there's more interesting research that potentially can be done up here, especially in the face of a warming climate. So I'm going to go to a diagram that some of you might have seen. I set out to do this to try to get a handle on this kind of quality production characteristic for varieties. I did this with most of the very wide mainstream varieties that are planted worldwide, looking at, for an average growing season temperature, Northern Hemisphere, April through October, Southern Hemisphere, October through May, and dividing them out into these just four broad categories, but mostly looking at these windows of varieties in terms of how they ripen or mature to a relatively high quality standard. Large amounts of data went into this, and it's pretty clear if you think about where historic varieties have been grown and where they are grown today, that all of them have these climatic thresholds for optimum quality and production. It's pretty clear. Pinot Noir, I'm going to give an example of that in Grenache. There's two different varieties here. But Pinot Noir exhibits one of the most narrow climatic niches for premium quality. Whoops, I jumped too fast there. If we look at Pinot Noir across this spectrum, we know it can be grown back over here in a cooler climate, but it typically, it doesn't ripen completely quality. It doesn't have the toxicity that we would associate with high-quality Pinot Noir. We know it can be grown over here, but it typically grows into bulk wine or jug wine, and that's pretty clear. And so this window right here, this climatic niche window, is roughly about 4 degrees Fahrenheit in terms of its width. That's the niche, so to speak, for that variety to produce high-quality wine worldwide. Okay? Now, I want to put some box ends on this. This vertical line right here in the green and the horizontal bar right here is Burgundy's long-term, roughly 60-year average climate. So this is the average, and this right here is their 1.5 standard deviations of that climate. So if you look at that, you can say, well, Burgundy in terms of Pinot Noir, of course, is somewhat centered to that. But in some years, it's pretty challenged. It's right toward the edge of that suitability window. And in other years, it might be up at a little bit higher. You can also look at the places in the world that grow Pinot Noir. The Tamar Valley of Tasmania, arguably one of the coolest high-quality Pinot Noir producing regions in the world, versus the Russian River Valley of Northern California, one of the warmest. So that's kind of an idea, just looking at one variety. We'll come back and look at some other aspects of this variety here in just a minute. But I wanted to go off and also look at Grenache. I think Grenache is kind of interesting because it's a variety that's grown in a lot of places, but is not really focused to a varietal premium quality, except for in the fairly narrow range. So Grenache over here is largely produced for rosé wine production, while Grenache over here is largely produced for blending production, with a little bit more quality framework going to be across the center zone for that variety. So I wanted to show a way in which I've been using global climate data to map out these thresholds. This right here takes that concept, and this is a split map. It's actually cut in half. So this is April through October, and this is October through April. So these are the growing seasons in each hemisphere. And all I've done is I've taken all the data I've been able to collect for Grenache and looking at its growing season average temperature thresholds of about a 6 degree climate edge, and I've mapped them. Just basically said at a 1 kilometer resolution, how can I map these globally? And this is what you come out with. Now, a lot of people in China may be very happy that you can grow Grenache up in here, right down into the Koreas, Japan, parts of Eastern Europe, a lot of the middle part of the United States. And you can see a lot of different places show up climatically that have similar growing seasons. But there may be other limitations to that. So this map is not getting at other limitations that could be issues for Grenache. It just gets at broadly suitable kind of areas. Just to show you an example, looking a little bit closer to this, we can go to Europe. There was a Grenache symposium this past June that I presented some stuff at, and this map kind of largely gets at where Grenache is grown in Europe. And you can see here's kind of the ancestral kind of home of Grenache here. It's also grown to a large degree down in La Mancha, this part of Spain, a little bit in Portugal, and a little bit down here in Italy as well. So that's just kind of an example of trying to take what we know about a variety's kind of niche and mapping to be able to see where it might exist out there in the world. We'll come back and take a look at this as we look at potentially how this landscape might shift for Grenache in just a little bit. So I want to talk now going from climate structure and suitability kind of issues into climate variability and talk a little bit about this aspect, because when we talk about climate change, we really need to look at how the climate varies as well, because climate change and climate variability are very much tied together, because one can strongly influence the other. And I'm going to show you a diagram here. This is very simple. Anybody can do this. You take a data set from a location, you calculate out growing degree days. Does everybody know what growing degree days are? I think I'm hoping that the audience generally knows. A measure of suitability for growing individual crops in a given region. This is a very simple formulation, going from the 60s to the late 2000s here. And this just happens to be somewhere in my region, but I can show you hundreds of these from many different locations. And when we look at this, typically we look at it from a lot of different perspectives, either a scientist or a grower. We could look at it in a couple of different frameworks. Number one, if you divided this out into two periods, this right over here, this envelope from 1965 to 1986, the average degree days during that period was 2466, with about 190 standard deviation year to year. So in this envelope right here, a grower might be doing something very different than a grower in that envelope. Okay. This envelope from 87 to 2000 shows a pretty substantial shift in the mean and a substantial shift in the envelope overall in terms of where they're growing the grapes. And if you look at the average numbers here, this right here, if I were consulting with a grower what to plant in these two environments, they would be largely a different mix of varieties. Same site, different mix over two different periods of time. Also notice here something else that's important. The standard deviation is roughly the same. And so what I'm getting at there is that even though we can sit there and say that this is the trend, underlying trend there, there is variability. There's variability off that trend or that mean line that's very similar in both above or below those values. One of the things I think is important with this is that when we talk to people, the public in general especially, they think climate change does this, right up that line. But climates don't change that way. There's a lot of variability about that change. And understanding that variability is extremely important in terms of how we might be growing a given crop in that climate. So looking at some climate variability mechanisms, there's a lot of acronyms up here that some of you may have some familiarity with, and others might not. But these are all the broad scale climate teleconnection indices or mechanisms by which we talk about the influence they might have in a given region. So for example, when we go back out here to the West Coast where I live, we're strongly influenced by what's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation and El Nino Southern Oscillation. These two things work in somewhat unison. When they're out of sequence from each other, when one's warm and the other one's cold, we get a completely different signal from them than when they're modulating each other and they're both warm or both cold. Very different kind of signal. This past growing season, and I'll talk about a little bit more in the western United States, was largely a result of some pretty amazing things that happened here. Arctic Oscillation and the North Atlantic Oscillation kind of interact a little bit to produce variability in the western or in the eastern United States and in Europe. You go down to Australia, a strong interaction between the Antarctic Oscillation, the Indian Ocean Dipole, and El Nino Southern Oscillation. And it's largely been shown that that past 15 years or so of drought in Australia have been really tied to how these two right here couple together. And that this Indian Ocean Dipole is a very prominent player producing basin scale variability from South Africa to Australia in terms of rainfall. And you can go to different areas, just sea surface temperature variations across this area of the South Atlantic. And ENSO tends to play a role in pretty much everywhere. So it's a major player. My sense of this from all the work that I've done with it and the work I've seen from others is that most of these mechanisms are very strongly winter or spring dominant, but they can have some pretty strong vintage effects depending on the region. Much interaction between regional and distant mechanisms is evident. What I'm getting at is this, is that we often hear how prominent the ENSO effect is, but at least where I live, you can't talk about ENSO without knowing what's happening with the PDO, because they work together. Okay, so there are mechanisms that work together on a kind of a large scale, and the same thing could be said about any of the other mechanisms. In viticulture and oenology research, impact studies are lacking in many regions. Just haven't been done. There's not very many climatologists diving into that, or there's not many people in viticulture regions looking at that research from their side. So I think there's some very fruitful kind of areas of research in terms of that. So I want to talk a little bit about North America, but a little bit more focused to the western United States as well. Most of our variability is induced by what's happening both in sea surface temperatures and the circulation of the atmosphere as a response to those sea surface temperatures. And this occurs out over the Pacific, across North America, and over the Atlantic, downstream into Europe, and so on and so forth. But mostly what we talk about when we look at this kind of thing is we look at how the flow is going across the United States and how it's being affected by water temperatures out over here. We can have very strong zonal flow coming across the U.S., which typically means one set of characteristics in terms of how it brings systems through the United States. We can also talk about strong meridional flow. And in this case, over the western United States, this would be ridging flow. Strong ridging flow over the western United States in a given period of the year is very suitable for ripening, producing dry conditions and kind of temperatures, day-night temperature differences that we want during ripening. But this right here can change and also be meridional flow trophic. And we've been set up in a kind of a unique situation this year where we've had more troughing than we've had ridging. And we've had a very interesting Western U.S. Kind of climate pattern because of that. But this kind of pattern structure develops by what's happening usually in the sea surface temperature fields out over the Pacific and or the Atlantic, depending on which way you're looking. I want to talk a little bit, again, going back to the West Coast, because even though it's a little bit upstream of here, it still has some prominent kind of effects here. This is the mean sea surface temperature field over 71 to 2000. But this also plays a very prominent role in kind of talking about what's happened this past year. We've had what's called a negative phase of the PDO, which means that we've had very warm water out over the Pacific and fairly cold water along the coastal zones of northwestern North America. That cold water produces cold water upwelling all along the coast. So what that does is it does a couple of things. Number one, the colder water doesn't put as much moisture into the atmosphere directly, but it also moderates temperatures lower. Then if you take the atmosphere flowing across this warmer water and it picks up moisture and it moves across the colder water, what do you think it produces? Marine layer clouds. So you have more marine layer incursions into the coastal areas, so it tends to cool down those areas even more. Doesn't mean it necessarily rains more, it just means that places that normally have fog that clear off by 9, 10 in the morning now have it to 12, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. That completely changes the growing environment. That's largely what we have seen this past year. But this has also been coupled with La Nina conditions where it's been fairly cold out over the tropical Pacific. And these two things in unison have put us in a perspective in the West Coast. We had the warmest January and February on record, followed by the coolest April, May, and June since the 1960s. And really what happened downstream is you guys got the benefit. You had a very good growing season because we were suffering. So you can laugh at that. Have some fun with it. Californians can suffer every now and then, right? So anyway, these two situations, if we look at these, if I were talking with people out west right now, talking about whether we're in a cold PDO or neutral ENSO or cold PDO La Nina, and we're actually in this phase right now, then this is what we're typically going to see. Cooler growing seasons across the west, with wetter Pacific Northwest and dry south. And this played out perfectly. It was just more extreme than anybody thought. And downstream, of course, it ended up being a fairly nice growing season here. We typically would expect also colder winters and more snowpack to the Pacific Northwest and dry and warmer conditions south. So this is what we're looking at this coming winter across the west. Now, downstream here, the type of effects that you would typically see is almost completely opposite of that. You would not expect the winter to be quite as cold this year, given that we're going to have a cold winter out west. Not expect. So anyway, that's a little bit overall on the climate variability piece. And the reason I think that's very important is that all of the research that I've been looking at is showing us that variability is actually increasing in many places, meaning that there's a lot of change going on both in the average structure of the climate, but also the variability of the climate too. So those two things are coupled together. So what I'm going to do now is kind of walk through some observations on climate change. And I think I got a current news update. I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to this, but the past decade was the warmest on record. If you look at the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. By the way, is that what we call it, the 2000s? Or is it the knots? Will we really know that until about 20 years from now? 70s, 80s, 90s, the 2000s, if you look at the numbers in terms of it relative to a base period of 51 to 80, the 2000s were the warmest decade in the last four over the globe. Note that it hasn't necessarily been warm everywhere. There are some places that have been either very near average or just slightly cooler than average. Globally, it was the third hottest August on record, and I heard September is pretty darn close to that as well. More significantly, it's the hottest January through August on record, overall 0.67 degrees Celsius above that base period. And kind of some interesting, they're comparing here in this diagram from NASA, 2010, 2005, and 1998, which are a collection of the warmest years recently. And if you look at the anomalies down in here, you can see 2010 in red. We largely had this extremely warm spring period globally. But we're a little bit below what happened in 1998 right now, at least, tracking a little bit more about 2005. I think the wild card for us coming up is what happens back through here. Whether 2010 will end up being the warmest on record or not, it's kind of a still to be seen. So this is also for the southern hemisphere. This diagram right here goes back especially to December, January, February 2010, looking at their summer, especially down in some of the Great Barrier regions here. Notice that especially for Australia, it was the warmest December to February period, second warmest on record since 1880, but that parts of southern Chile and southern Argentina, it was pretty close to normal. So you're very right, but the signal is not the same everywhere. Many places are seeing higher nighttime temperatures, that's pretty clear, but not everywhere. We were talking about this earlier, the Central Valley of California, because of all the irrigation that's used there now, has tremendously higher nighttime temperatures than it ever did. But its daytime temperatures are staying either flat or going down because there's more moisture in the atmosphere. And so there's an example of nighttime temperatures going up. But there are other places where that extra added irrigation input is not happening, where daytime temperatures are going up more than nighttime. So of all the stations I've looked at in wine regions worldwide, I would tend to point to more about 60 to 70% of them warming at night more than during the day. But there's still a significant number that are warming during the day. Those mean different things to different varieties. Nighttime elevated temperatures means the vine's going to work just as hard at night doing things. Higher daytime temperatures, added stress, added recovery issues for photosynthetic development, all kinds of things. So they're very different responses. Anyway, I think we're back and we don't have that Art Deco thing. So all of this is kind of interesting because NASA predicted back in April that it's nearly certain that 12-month global temperature will be record will be set in 2010. The only wild card that I think that is out there right now is the dissipation of what, and I apologize that I didn't change this. We've actually transitioned already out of an El Nino into a La Nina. And so if I could strike that off and I could say La Nina event, it's even more magnified because of the fact that La Nina events typically produce a cooler global climate than an El Nino event. So it's pretty amazing that we're even in this framework. But the other piece of this is that the record temperatures we're seeing are especially impressive because we've been in the deepest solar minimum in nearly a century. So if we come out of that solar minimum to a solar maximum that's either at projections or greater than, people are saying that it'll even get warmer. So there's some definite issues there that we have to pay attention to over the short term.
Sorry, can you just describe the solar minimum?
A solar minimum, activity from the solar surface. It's either at a, it goes through an 11-year cycle from a max to a minimum, but we've been in a long, deep minimum for a while now. So talk a little bit about some of the just generalized effects, and I'll show you some diagrams and maps associated with this. We know that we've seen changes in average climate structure and variability out there in the world in terms of growing grapes and making wine. The variability component of it, I think, is very important because we have seen this both in wintertime temperatures and in summertime temperatures. So there's a definite change in both structure and variability. We've seen warmer and longer growing seasons. I can tell you right now, for every place that I've ever touched data, it is not getting shorter and cooler. There aren't places that are doing that. So everything is warmer and longer in terms of the overall growing season structure. We've seen warmer dormant periods. For some places, this has been more problematic than others. Grapevines don't quite need the same chilling requirements that other horticultural crops do, but they still function best. Buds are still the most viable when there's some chilling. And if you have a lack of chilling, then it's a definite issue. And this has been problematic in a few places. There has been reduced frost damage in some areas, not everywhere. We've seen that even though the median frost date has shifted a little bit, that when it does occur, it can be just as problematic in that region. So a little bit less damage, but not everywhere. We've also seen altered ripening profiles. And I can't sit up here and say that climate is the sole responsibility of this. But we live in an environment where we're making wines to meet a marketplace. And so the market has driven some of this. The bigger, bolder wines that we have today that clearly are much more fruit-driven or higher alcoholic wines, those are largely driven by a couple of other forces. But you can't do it without having a climate that's suitable for it. And so I've always argued that even though someone might say that Robert Parker has caused ripening profiles to be different, well, sure, he might have had a big hand in it, but you can't do it without a warmer climate. Okay? So the climate is definitely playing a role. We've also seen earlier phenological or plant growth events pretty much globally. I'll show you some different results from that in a couple of different regions. We've seen some altered and or new disease or pest severity and timing kind of issues that are showing up. We have some things starting to show up out west that are quite a problem. Spotted wing Drosophila, mealybugs, moths that have really been problematic that didn't show up and have as much potential as they do today because the climates are just that much more suitable to their life cycle. Changes in soil fertility and erosion, some places probably more problematic than in other places. The soil fertility issue may come down to a lot of different nutrients, but salt issues in soils have been very problematic. I think you're looking at some of the saline rootstock issues in Chile. Where are you doing your work in Chile or here in the States? I'm sorry, I was trying to, I thought, were you at lunch earlier today?
No.
No, I'm sorry, I keyed off on the wrong person. Is he here? No.
He's working on salts in greenhouse crops.
Okay, greenhouse crops, sorry. I keyed off on the wrong person. I did that in my classes all so you can make fun. Now, but changes in soil fertility and salinity are very problematic. The Australians have been doing some great work looking at rootstocks for grapevines that are much more salt tolerant than soils. The erosion piece of it really is tied back to the fact that a lot of our precipitation events appear to be coming in heavier amounts instead of being more spread out in more individual events. And one of the classics here is that go to some of the steep slope viticulture in Europe. I remember the very first time I ever saw this, that I was touring a place about 15, 20 years ago. And there was a bulldozer at the start of this place that we were doing this tour. There was a bulldozer down at the bottom of the slope, and it was going along the end of the vine. And then after a while we were talking, the next thing I knew, it was up at the top of the slope. What it was doing is it was redistributing the soil that had been eroded down to the bottom and coming from heavy rain events. And from the people I've talked to in parts of Germany, this is becoming more common practice because of that kind of heavy rain event influence. This is a big question mark that I have, CO2 fertilization. The first piece of this, I think, is very important. I think this is an extremely large area for study. I just don't think we've done very much overall. There's been some controlled greenhouse environment studies looking at, of course, CO2 and its role in terms of how the vine grows or maybe how yield or fruit production is different. But we haven't taken it to the place to really understand what effect that has on the wine. If you double the CO2 environment, what is the wine output like? I mean, does the wine have the same typicity? Does it have the same ageability? All of those kinds of things. That work just really hasn't been done to any large degree. Other areas that could be an interesting area of areas of study would be, how about oak for barrels? Changes in CO2 environments and how that might influence the grain and the material in the oak. Could be a very interesting area. So these are kind of things that really haven't been done very much that I think are very important. Water availability and timing for irrigation. We've seen quite a few places getting much drier. Some places getting a little bit wetter. Depending on the time of season, it could be a real problem. I know of some research that we've looked at in Spain. In some region, the rainfall amounts right around bloom have been getting significantly higher. And that's a problem for flower set, or flowering and fruit set. So it just depends on kind of the timing of that kind of water issue. But the timing of irrigation is also pretty critical as well. So anyway, that's kind of a laundry list. I'm going to walk through a few things here. I published this research back in 2005. And we looked at 27 different wine regions, everything in red there, in the red points, over about a 50-year period. And what we found is that the average growing season warming was 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit over that 50-year period. Does anybody remember what the Pinot Noir climate niche was?
4 degrees.
And it's just one variety to kind of peg on, but the idea is that a warming of 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit in a place growing Pinot Noir could put it outside that suitability pretty easily, depending on where they started. Okay, so that's kind of the idea there. We also found dormant season warming a little bit higher, but across a few less locations. We found that 18 and 27 regions showed increased variability, or the variance in those growing season temperatures went up. And the warming trends were a little bit more significant and greater magnitude in the northern hemisphere versus the southern hemisphere. And so I think that's been found in most of the climate studies that are out there. We'll come back and look at these here in just a minute as well. So this is some work I published with a bunch of colleagues from each one of these locations here, where we collaborated on putting together quite a bit of climate data and phenological data, looking at what was happening in these regions. And this is just kind of a laundry list of the types of changes that we're seeing there. Looking at growing season temperatures warming across these sites by just over 3 degrees Fahrenheit. In this case, these were almost all minimum temperature changes. Not all of them, but almost all of them. Decline in the number of days below freezing, shifts in frost dates in a longer frost-free period. No real trends in precipitation. When we looked at phenology across many varieties across all these locations, this is what we found for bud break, bloom, veraison, and harvest dates, 6, 11, 15, 17 days earlier. Some pretty tremendous changes across a range of varieties. But this is the one that I think is physiologically the interesting piece of it. The intervals between these events all got shorter. So the grapevine tends to show us that it's moving forward in time, responding to the climate, but the intervals of growth between the events have gotten shorter. These are all statistically significant across many varieties. So the issue, what does that mean physiologically to the vine as it's developing and trying to produce fruit in that kind of environment? I've got a project going with a gentleman right here, Diego Tomasi from Conegliano. We're looking at over 100 different indigenous varieties and using the exact same kind of signal. So shortening of the growth cycles and shifting to earlier events. So one of the things that I think is kind of interesting from this piece of work, because it tied back and really connected to others as well, is that when you look across numerous varieties and location, there's a 3 to 6 day event or response per 1 degree Fahrenheit of warming. I have found this in virtually all pieces of research I've seen. It's usually right around 3 to 6 degrees per 1 degree Fahrenheit. Australia, New Zealand, Europe, Western United States, everything's about the same. It's a piece of research that I was talking with somebody earlier about Hans Schultz and some work that we're doing. Yes, we were, Hans and I are about ready to publish this here, looking at some data from Schloss-Johannesburg that goes back into the 1780s. And these are harvest dates. We also have Oschlei, sugar levels and acid levels and production and quality metrics for this whole site, publishing this whole thing. But this is, these are harvest dates. And if you look at this, this is the overall average characteristics. Median harvest date over this time period of 24th of October. But this is the interesting one. A 60-day range from the earliest to the latest in terms of what climate really is can produce there. If you look at an underlying trends, just a moving average, decade of moving average, that's what it looks like. However, if you do a breakpoint analysis looking at where the shift is, it's in 1885. So right in here is the trend shifts to this direction. And the overall trend right here is roughly about 2 days per decade overall. And I'm missing a couple of years here, but they're all right there. Okay. So again, some harvest dates evidence going on in the Rhine Valley. These are also some spatial kind of things going on in the Rhine Valley. Anybody been here before? I've got a few people, just to give you a sense of what's happening here. Geisenheim's right here on the river, Rüdesheim right next to it. Geisenheim, Johannesburg, a little town in the Chateau's right up in here. If you come down the river and you go around this corner right here, this is what you see. And And this is Hans's water irrigation trial. How would you like to do that for a trial? It's pretty steep slopes to move up and down. But he helped do some recovery of some of these vines, and he's doing a trial right in there right now. So this is the area. Everything in red is where the grape growing area is defined there. And these are maps looking at something called the Huguenin Index. Has anybody ever heard of the Huguenin Index? Okay. If you know what growing degree days are, the Huguenin Index is the French counterpart. Huguenin developed it in terms of looking at grape growing potential in Europe based upon, instead of just going T max, T min, divided, coming up with an average over some base, what he did is he paid more attention to maximum temperatures. So they're weighted more heavily. And then he uses what's called a day length factor to adjust for increasing day lengths as you go higher in latitude. So, but anyway, the biggest story with that is that his index goes from green cool climate varieties to reds warm climate varieties, just like you would imagine in a degree day formula. And here we are in the 1980s, being at the cool climate limit to production down in this area, and going up into, arguably into areas that if you look at his specifications for varieties, this green right here, the lighter green, is Merlot. And what do they grow in this region? Riesling. Okay, so that's just 1980 to 2000. Okay, we'll come back and take a look at that in just a minute as well. So this is some observed elevational changes. You've probably heard that, of course, as climates change, you move up in elevation, you can get back to a different climate structure. I wanted to talk about some work done by some colleagues and I in that region, looking at a 200-meter elevational difference between Beaune and La Rochebeau. Most of the vineyards are planted between Dijon and La Rochebeau, either right along this purple escarpment or up into this lighter gray area. And this is a diagram that looks at the dates of maturity versus the mean temperatures from April through September. And this is Beaune, 73 to 87, 88 to 2006. Anybody know what year that is?
2003.
A real extreme year in Europe. And I'll use that as an example a couple more times here in a minute. So here's La Rochebeau, 73 to 87, 88 to 2006, 2003. If you put the two together, what does it tell you? It tells you that La Rochebeau, in this period, the later period, has the climate that Beaune had in the earlier period. That right there is just a simple elevational shift in terms of if you were trying to look at getting an average maturity structure, you'd have to go up 200 meters in elevation. Okay, so this kind of thing is happening in a lot of places, but this is a good example of that in the Burgundy. We did some research also that looked at growing regions out of the western United States. Very similar analysis that we did in Europe. Similar time period. Growing season temperatures went up 2.5, 3.1 in Europe. Napa warmed the most in the area. And again, driven by changes in minimum, not necessarily maximum temperatures, except for when you got down into a few places down here. Just depending on where you were. But Napa is warmed by 5.2 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 50 or so years. And that's a tremendous difference in nighttime temperatures during the growing season. Similar characteristics for frost and freeze issues, similar no trends in precipitation, and phenology trends are roughly about the same. I don't have as good a data for phenology over the western U.S. as I do in Europe, but the numbers are close to what we saw in Europe. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about kind of some observational things. Now let's look and take some of this and put it into the future in terms of just looking at generalized zones. If you take what I've been showing you a little bit, like this growing season average temperature isotherms, 54 to 72 degrees Fahrenheit. Again, this is a split map, northern hemisphere summer, southern hemisphere summer. Everything that's in this kind of green color here is what would be more or less suitable within those isotherms in the year 2000. If you take a mid-range scenario, A1B, from the Community Climate System model, and you map that out, the red line is what you would get out by 2100. Arguably 2100 is a little bit out there. We could back this down to 2050. It's still the same response. It's still moving in the same direction. direction, with isotherm shifting about 150 to 350 miles northward, depending on location, from 2000. The big issue here is that northern hemisphere has some expansion, you know, areas. Southern hemisphere doesn't have it, and there's mostly declines in suitable area for viticulture in the southern hemisphere. So there's some definite challenges there. I'm working with some people doing projects down here looking at this issue right now. So I told you I'd get back to Grenache climates again. So we mapped out where they are given what we know historically. And here we are looking at Grenache climates worldwide with roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming. A little bit hard to see. I'm going to show you Europe out here coming up in just a minute. But again, a split map, April through October, October, April. And areas in purple have now become too warm. Areas in the red are warm but still suitable, warmer but still suitable, and areas that are pink are new areas that are now within that framework. And you can see large areas that change in suitability. It's a little bit hard to see on this one, so let's go to Europe. And this is the changing map for Grenache climates, potentially looking out at 3 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. You can take some of the historic areas that used to be the most prime Grenache areas right in here, and you can see how the suitability changes. Does anybody know where Burgundy is, where they grow Pinot Noir? Right about there. Okay. You can see large areas of Spain change suitability structures, Italy as well. And again, this is just taking kind of what we know today about where Grenache has grown to high quality standards and mapping it for the future using output. So going back to this, looking at individual places, I already showed you what we found for these 27 regions from 1950 to 2000, but using an A1B scenario out to 2050, we showed trends that were 0.4 to 1.1 degree Fahrenheit per decade, or almost 4 degrees Celsius over the next 50 years averaged over all these regions. Again, what was the Pinot Noir climate niche? 4 degrees. So it almost doesn't matter if you're growing Pinot Noir, even at the low end of suitability, and you have this amount of warming, you're going to be at the high end or outside of it in terms of suitability. South Africa actually showed the lowest warming in this analysis we did, while Portugal and parts of the Iberian Peninsula showed the highest warming rates. And 20 of the 27 regions showed increased variability in the future. So what we've been seeing in the observations with increased variability is showing up in the future of our model as well. And the northern hemisphere warms just slightly more than the southern hemisphere. So let's go back here to the Rhine Valley. We were just looking at this in 1980, 90, and 2000. So let's take this same data and go to 2030, 2040, and 2050. This is done by Manfred Stock out of the PIC Potsdam Institute. And these kind of changes that you see here, going into this color spectrum right here, Hughlin identified these as places for Syrah and pretty soon Cabernet Sauvignon in a Riesling home, historically. I was talking about this earlier in our meeting, talking about Char's work in Nature. And this is that look of that data, and I wanted to show this because this gets at this idea of temperature variability, how much temperature variability is modeled to change out in the future. And you can see, of course, their temperature changes are supposed to, are projected to occur over large areas, but large, nearly 100% changes in variability in some more continental type of climate locations where some more coastal areas don't change quite as much. But again, modeling temperature variability in the future showing pretty significant change. I haven't talked a lot about precipitation, largely because models diverge a lot and observations are not showing a lot of trends, but this is some work that a colleague in Portugal recently did looking at something called a dryness index. And for those that are doing any climate work in viticulture at all, this is a pretty good index. It's a mechanism of getting at, I think, a better measure of potential evapotranspiration of water needs in a given area. And it's a fairly easy index to calculate. I can give it to you later. But this is a dryness index looking at two different scenarios. The C20 is the current conditions. But the big thing as we kind of go through time here is noting that everything tends to get more red and yellow over time. meaning the dryness index over most of Europe is showing drying over time. And if you know anything about Europe and water resources and the ability of the irrigation, it's just not much of it. Okay, so there's some real issues there in terms of potential water availability, especially in some of these already extremely water-limited regions. A colleague of mine, Andrew Hall in Australia, we published this a while back looking at similar kind of changes in Australia, looking at mean growing season temperatures from 71 to 2000 to out to 2070. I just color-coded this by what type of suitability it might be for grape growing. Most of the major landscape for bulk wine production is in this very hot zone right in here. If you look at over time, we see that that area tends to contract southward or toward the South Pole. And there's a changing suitability along the coastal zones and down to Tasmania. So this is an Australian Journal of Grape and Wine Research. Leanne Webb, Snow Barlow, and Penny Wetton in 2007 also did some work looking at this stuff for Australia. And they were looking at phenological shifts and found that they varied by region, with bud burst 6 to 13 days earlier by 2050, harvest 9 to 18 days earlier by 2050, and the season duration was getting shorter. Again, that shortening of the life the cycle of growth, 15 to 31 days by 2050, and that they used a kind of a surrogate for quality, what people were willing to pay for the grapes there's a term that they use for them, but anyway, they used a surrogate for wine grape quality of cost of those grapes, and what they found is that wine quality impacts basically by changing costs were to be varied by region and variety from 12 to 57%. A little bit of work I did done in the western United States, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, California. This is the kind of standard degree day formulation that's normally discussed as Winkler regions, region 1 through 5, but values of degree days here down the side. And again, kind of color-coded by the type of varieties or wine styles you might be thinking about producing there. This is the 71 to 2000 data. If you look at a couple of locations in here, we have Walla Walla, the Willamette Valley, and Napa. These have historically been, that's not responding, there we go, have historically been regions 2 to 3 up in here for Walla Walla, region 1, cool climate for the Willamette, and regions 3 to 4 for Napa Valley. If you go to 2 degree Fahrenheit warming and you look at that framework, here we go, and it shifts these regions, Walla Walla to a 3-4, the Willamette Valley from a 1 to a 1-2, and Napa Valley from a 4 to a 3-4 to a 4-5. And again, the climate here would be much more like the climate here during this time period. This is the basic shift. If you go to a little bit more extreme, about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, look at those same regions, Walla Walla, 4-5, a 2 in the Willamette Valley, and a 5 in Napa. Now, I mean, again, these are projections looking out in climate, but let's just say, what if these do come true? And this is where our climates are going in terms of change. If what we know today is correct about what varieties can grow in what kind of climates, this right here is table grapes and raisins, or maybe bulk wine production at the best. And so, again, if what we know today, without any further adaptation or change in varieties, is correct, that's what we know. Okay? A place like the Willamette Valley up here could go from a traditional cool climate to maybe a little bit more intermediate climate, shift to different varieties potentially. So I'm going to go back here, and I'm going to go ahead and put Burgundy in this context just real quick. I'll show you some stuff. It's a little bit dated. I probably need to update this now, but looking at data, I want to show vertical blue lines, green lines, and red lines relative to 25-year periods, 55 to 80, 80 to 2005, 2005 to 2030. And if we look at Burgundy historically from our current period, so to speak, this is what we've had. But growing seasons from 55 to 1980 were on average like the coldest of years during this 80 to 2005 period. If we go to projections 2005 to 2030, growing season average temperatures are projected to be like the warmest of years during this current period. Now, I told you I'd get back to the 2003. Where do you think 2003 sits in Burgundy in terms of its climate? Well, it's clearly going to be the right. Okay, but how far? And this is the amazing thing about it. That was 2003's average climate for Burgundy. So one of the things that, people in Europe are looking at now, trying to understand impacts in the future, is that was 2003 an anomaly, a real anomaly, or was it something that might be the average conditions in the future? Because that means completely two different things. And so there's some real issues about looking at that as a scenario or an analog for the future. Okay, so now I can go away from pictures and just talk a little bit about some summary stuff. And I think a lot of this is pretty evident. Viticulture and wine production is pretty climatically sensitive. There's just no doubt. Much of our crop production out there is, but wine production and viticulture is clearly very sensitive. There's clearly narrow zones that exist out there in the world for being able to grow given varieties to given quality or production standards. As such, if we look at this relative to many other types of crops, because of this narrow kind of climatic niching and its sensitivity, this is a pretty sensitive crop system overall to variations and changes in climate. Climate structure and suitability, I think I've said some out there is, but wine production and agriculture is clearly very sensitive. There's clearly narrow zones that exist out there in the world for being able to grow given varieties to given quality or production standards. As such, if we look at this relative to many other types of crops, because of this narrow kind of climatic niching and its sensitivity, this is a pretty sensitive crop system overall to variations and changes in climate. Climate structure and suitability, I think I've said some of this. I really truly think, after being one of the few people looking at this in depth for the past 20 years, that we have an incomplete understanding of global structure and suitability for all varieties. I just haven't done my job. Or maybe I'm just starting to kind of understand what to do. But I think that there's so much that needs to be known, especially these upper limit issues. How can we adapt to them, or how to find adapt to upper limit temperatures? Climate variability issues. Variability in wine regions has increased, typically, in most regions, and is projected to increase even more in the future. We need to understand the range of variability and extremes to be able to give adaptive capacity understanding to growers. There's no doubt. Climate change issues. Observed warming is evident, some benefits and opportunities, but there's been negative impacts as well. So there's clearly benefits and opportunities, but there are negative impacts, and the question really is that are there future thresholds by which those negative impacts become more prominent? I've done a meta-analysis looking at all kind of climate change research, looking at growing grapes in wine regions worldwide. They indicate 2.5 to 4.5 degree Fahrenheit warming by 2050. And some of the phenological modeling that's been looking at as well, it's again showing a shifting in the phenological timing and more contraction of the intervals between phenological events. However, there's lots of uncertainties that exist in there. We really need to understand what those are, again, so we can kind of build in some adaptive capacity. And that gets to this piece here. You know, my family's in this business, so I get to kind of see both sides of it. I deal with it quite a bit. And I really understand this, that as growers and producers, we continually undergo tactical and strategic changes in climate conditions, but we don't do it in isolation. There are a lot of other things that are influencing us. We typically operate in a multi-risk environment. We have climate issues to deal with. Markets, of course, and policy. Do you think that Europeans have more latitude to change versus the New World? No, not unless our governments get on board to really help them understand what kind of adaptive potential there is. But right now, there's more protection and structural laws that keep them from adapting. Glad that wasn't mine. The status of adaption that is currently ongoing within any system is going to determine the future vulnerabilities in that system. I do think that the gradual nature of climate change typically will provide those that are aware and those that are willing to understand that there's an issue sufficient time to develop and utilize adaptation strategies. However, we really truly need some research, innovation, and technology transfer to allow that to occur. What I'm seeing from that whole side of this issue of climate change is that it's just not out there for the growers in ways that I think is powerful enough for them to utilize and to put into place. Important areas of research, just real quick. These are things that I think are out there. Understanding cultivar suitability and adaptability, again, big area. I think we're doing some great research out there in the world, but it's just not completed. There's a lot of room there. Carbon source seep issues, space experiments, other kinds of CO2 type studies I think are very prevalent and needed. Traditional plant breeding and genetics. Did you guys hear recently about the 8 or 9 year study that was ripped out in Alsace recently? There was a genetic study that was done looking at producing rootstocks that would fight nematode resistance and other issues. And it was all done in genetics. And a left-wing group went out in the middle of the night and tore out 9 or 10 years worth of growth and somewhere around like 2 million euros worth of investment, all because it was genetic work that arguably we've been doing for a long time. So anyway, we need to do some more of that kind of stuff, there's no doubt. Vineyard management adjustments. I talked to somebody else about this earlier today. I think there's a large amount of adaptation that can occur here if we can study it enough to know how to make those changes. For example, the move to very tight VSV controlled vine structure. If you're in a very warm climate, all you got to do is go away from that a little bit and you've given your vines some leeway to adapt. We need to know what that looks like. And so while we've studied how to go to VSP and maximize the system, we may need to study how to detune it, so to speak. Winery processing, fermentation issues. I'm not a enologist by trade, but there's clearly a lot of things that need to be looked at in terms of maybe potentially using yeast strains that don't convert alcohol levels quite as high. A lot of different processes, I think, the social science framework of things. I'm on a graduate committee right now looking at cultural vulnerability and adaptability to change. How vulnerable are breakthroughs and how adaptable are they to change? It's an important issue for us to understand. And physical scientists typically, I'm not going to look at anything, but we need that social side to kind of look at that issue. Economic sustainability issues that typically come into play, trying to really be within a very difficult system that takes a lot of money and investment and be sustainable. It's a challenge. Market issues, brand recognition, and adaptability. I know I've talked a little bit about Burgundy in here, but just think about Burgundy, who's been growing Pinot Noir off and on in different ways for maybe 1,000 years. What happens if the government all of a sudden gives them the right to grow Syrah, which is suitable from a climate standpoint? How do they deal with the brand recognition and their identity to that whole chain? That's a costly and very difficult question to answer, but it's something that needs to be looked at. So research areas need to kind of understand or help understand kind of some of those changes that come about in the cultural side of things. And then lastly, whether we like it or not, we ask governments to do things for us, and they're going to do them. Cap and trade. Regulation, it will happen. I think this industry is much more proactive than some. It still needs to be better. When the cap and trade framework comes down, however it comes down to the industry, they need to know how much of a source versus how much of a sink and how they can play the game. And without having the background knowledge on that, it's going to be difficult. So I think that's a big area of research as well. So I'm sure I talked too much, but I enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Temperatures, and the other was the shift of growing time. all your data was always between April and October. But you tell us things are getting earlier. So the grapes are no longer growing April to October. Sure. They grow in February to August.
Yeah, you're right.
And you answered this by saying, oh, yes, the zones are going to move. But to what extent would any growing area be able to solve this problem by just growing the grapes automatically growing earlier, which you did indicate with the changing times?
And yeah, you're right. And I've thought about this in many different ways, trying to come up with a mechanism. Because if you look at trying to map suitability from, let's say, Washington to California, the growing seasons are different. But the real question is, how do you map that with maybe, say, a March through September, or even a mid-February through mid-August kind of framework, versus somewhere else being April through October? Are they equivalent? And I don't necessarily have a good answer to that, other than that you do know that things are shifting. And so if they are shifting, let's say that the growing season becomes a March through September framework. So the grapevine is moving and shifting in terms of its growth cycle, but it's ripening in a hotter period of the year. So there's still some impacts there. And I'm not so sure I have the answers, but I understand where you're coming from.
Just another ingredient to add to this boiling pot. Photoperiod is certainly going to be different. If the growing period starts in February, temperature-wise, you're still going to have shorter day lengths. I don't know what that throws into the equation.
Yeah. And that might be part of that wild card in there, is that photoperiod kind of effect. That does need to be brought in.
Sort of a speculative question. I'm going to ask you to speculate wildly. When you talk about what makes suitable wine, what climate, for instance, is good for Pinot Noir, I think you can make an argument that what we think is good Pinot Noir was set back in the 1800s when French established their structure and we decided to have two Pinot Noirs. So, but in 2003 they made Pinot Noir and they sold it. And wine keeps, as the temperature gets warmer, the wine keeps getting more expensive. And me being a little bit older, I'm having a harder time finding wine today than I like because my palate was set 20 years ago. So, to what extent do you think this problem just won't be solved by marketing? That 20 years from now, the wine drinkers of then will say a great Pinot Noir comes from Burgundy, even though it's a completely different Pinot Noir.
Sure, I mean that's kind of a good question, but there may be a lot of different thoughts I have. Today the big bold structure of wine it's like you said, your tastes have been set back in some period before that when the wines were maybe more elegant or refined. And myself too. And so if I look at the wine styles that are out there today, for me, I always look at it and go, who decided that I need to drink that kind of wine? I don't like 16% alcohol and big over the top wines that don't go with my food. But that's what the market has given to us. But go out to California and see what's going on there. There's a backlash going on right now. There's a whole movement. There are liquor stores, wine shops, big shops that will not carry any wine over 14% alcohol. And it's because they're backlashing against the fact that winemakers have been making wines to fit wine judging and critics and ratings. And I think that's a whole different world in terms of how they need to kind of market that. I know a lot of winemakers today in California that in their contracts, it says you get a 95 or above by Robert Parker and you get a bonus of X. So what are they going to do? But those are not the kind of wines that you and I want to drink, right? So that's not really answering your question, but it gets back to the idea that, of course, markets will kind of change those things, but if you look at, let's just do a what if and say, let's go to a Burgundy climate 4 degrees warmer than today and think about sitting down to taste those wines. Can the market overcome the fact that Pinot Noir growing in a 4 degree warmer climate today than that is not good? Will the market forces, the judging, the ratings, the system, be able to tell us that that's good enough to make us drink? I don't know, I'm kind of speculating.
You talk about suitability mainly in terms of growing through your degree days. And of course, up here in the frozen north, the other portion of that is the vine surviving the winter. How much work has been done on the other half of this, which is the winter temperatures and vines being able to survive through the winter?
And
new locations.
Yeah, and I mean, you asked a very good question. There's a lot of people here at Cornell doing some very good work in that area, but just to back up a little bit and say that there are very few places in the world that have the same problem. I mean, just think about it. Where else has a winter minimum temperature problem like you do?
Minnesota.
But
they might have increased spring frost damage that could be just as catastrophic as an extreme winter low because of the earlier bud break and warming. So
sure.
It's the same problem at two different times of the year when you get excessively warm temperatures.
Sure, and I think what I was getting at is that this is a fairly unique situation in terms of growing grapes worldwide. A little bit of eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, a little bit of Idaho, parts of the very northern 8,000-foot area of Mendoza, Argentina, has some of this kind of issue. A little bit of Romania and eastern parts of Europe. But it's really not, there's not a lot. There has been some work looking at the issue of winter minimums. I did about it's 1913 to 2007. Assessment of the eastern Washington freezing packs. What we're finding is that the extremes were just as variable and just as deep as they used to be. What was changing a lot was the lower threshold extremes. You know, not the, say, negative 20 degrees, but the negative 5 degrees. There were much, much fewer of those. We still had the negative 20s. But see, I think that one of the challenges might come up for the vine system is this. If it's operating in a warmer environment during the wintertime, it's not used to those cold temperatures. If it goes through a period of 10, 15 years like that, and all of a sudden gets warm, is it more susceptible to damage? Likely. And I would say the same thing could happen to a spring frost. If a vine doesn't experience a spring frost for years, we even saw it in Oregon this year. I can even tell you from experience now that I think about it. Places that hadn't had a spring frost in 20 years at least had one this spring, and they were desperate. Absolutely decimated because they just hadn't had spring frost. So the acclimatization of the vine may be the bigger piece of it. I don't know, but you know.
Well, I can just add that in November or maybe early December, there's a report coming out on impacts of climate change in New York on New York agriculture, including a viticulture section that Alan Laxo, myself, and John Comstock, and others have been working on. So.
Hopefully,
you'll
also get a guest lecture and probably a class, I think.
The other part of that, though, Greg, is that the growers, we had severe damage in 04, 05, in part because it had been so long since we had a catastrophic winter freeze that the growers had stopped killing up.
Yeah.
So it's sort of human behavior after 20 years of not having a spring frost, and nobody had wind machines set up to run. So.
You know, somebody this spring who's had a wind machine on his property for years,
yeah.
And he forgot how to turn it on.
Yeah.
And when he got down to that one day that was the problem, couldn't get it going.
when you look at harvest dates, and how they change over the years, how do you account for some of the big changes in viticulture that have happened at the same time? You know, the introduction of rootstocks, new clonal material. When you look at 200 years from a recent producer, that's a very, it's almost a completely different viticultural system when you started.
This comes down to how much control can you have. And it's unfortunate that you can't have complete control. You can't have complete, but the one thing about, especially that recent data from Schlosser-Hansberg, is that those harvest dates are not based upon cultural decisions on when to go out and do it, but they're based upon reaching 60 degree motion. So you remove some of that issue. You haven't removed completely the issue of maybe a changing rootstock or a changing trellis system or something like that. But you've removed most of it. Some of the work that I've done in Europe, fortunately, that one study where I looked at phenology over a bunch of different locations, those all come from research sites. They're typically 20, 30 years standard. So that's pretty good data. pretty sure that, but you're right, if you just have generalized data from a given location, it's pretty hard to control those things.
Well, because even last year, I have a block of Riesling just meters away from Ian's block. And we harvested a week earlier at 3 grams per liter lower TAs, just because I think we did a little more chemical management through the year. And last year, when we had such a terrible year here, we saw a huge difference for growers who had just put in a bit of time in terms of chemical management, 2 or 3 degrees better, sure. And 2 or 3 grams per liter lower.
Yeah, and I would say that I've seen similar things like that in the other rooms too. So I guess the biggest thing is that in phenological studies, you got to have as much control as possible. Mm-hmm. But it's not, I don't think you can have everything.
So are you seeing companies like Constellation or, Saint-Michel, are they approaching you now saying, Greg, where should we be buying vineyard land so that we can continue
They've
to
They've already been doing it. Yeah. Big companies, one of the biggest is Torres in Spain. They've been buying huge amounts of land up in the foothills of the Pyrenees, trying to get it a little bit closer to available water and pounding sources and get to go up enough in elevation so they can get a couple of degrees of temperature. It's also happening with some of the larger companies. However, just like the American government, as we were ramping up to talk about climate change law, what happened when the economy tanked? So did the discussion. Most of the grape growers I know, or large companies, I should say, in the wine business, that were really truly looking at diversifying their land holdings have stopped. And I don't see it coming back for a few years until the economy gets better.
All the more reason why they're just going to convince you it's still great. Yeah.
You talk about buying up new land, that raises a point about the interaction between, you talk about climate variables, but what about like suitability maps in terms of soils and other variables? Does it end up being not congruent where?
I think there's some real problems. I'll just give a couple examples. One in my region, we historically have had almost 10 to 12,000 acres of pears as little as 15 years ago in the valley that I live in. We're down to about 6,000, 6,500 now. And the pear grower, the fruit growers league came to me at one point in time and asked me to look at how much pear acreage was suitable to grow grapes. And the number was very little. It was somewhere between 4% and 7%, depending on the area I was looking at. So very little suitable horticulture acreage for pears really would work for grapes. So there's a disconnect there. But in other grape growing regions, like for example in Burgundy, they can't go anywhere. There's no land there. Either that or it's all protected. So both of those kind of issues come into play. The other one in Oregon that's happening in a couple of other valleys is this. The protection of rural lands and agricultural lands becomes an issue because if you have a vineyard in a given landscape or an orchard in a given landscape, the government wants to protect that. Citizen groups want to protect it. If you wanted to pull that out and go plant up the hill somewhere, you actually have some problems from those groups doing that. So there's been a little bit of friction going on.
To what extent are people facing the inevitable and saying, okay, we need a grape and a system that will work under warmer conditions, so let's establish an experiment station that's now already hotter than what we would like to see for grapes?
I think that's ideal. I would stand here and tell you that I think the Australians have been at the forefront of research for a long time, looking at many, many different issues. But they just did something that I think was completely, I just can't even understand it. They closed down their warmest climate research station in Mervyn, up in the Mildura big production area. One of the hottest areas in all of the region where they had great research going on, they shut it down. And yet, that's the place where they needed to do the research to understand what was going to work. So I agree with you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.